think you'll have to speak up a little bit.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. And I have to thank SS Major also because he's hosting me today at Hamilton College. So what we can learn from shape dynamics and the argument that I want to lay out today is that maybe space-time plays a different role than we thought it did when we're searching for quantum gravity. And that's the picture on the title page is for this search for quantum gravity. So if we go to slide number 2, I have an outline of my talk. So I will start with the motivation from 2 plus 1 dimensional, from the 2 plus 1 dimensional path in the graph. And if you take what I write there seriously, then you can see that as a suggestion that the path integral, at least the metric path integral, suggests that formal evolution is more fundamental than the space-time picture. Now, then I will take that seriously, and I will look at the conformal evolution by itself. And in simple examples, in simple tractable examples, you can see that it will differ. It will, although it looks locally like general relativity, it will differ globally from a space-time that solves Einstein's equation. So then if you combine these two points together, you would have to abandon the space-time picture. But then in the last part of the talk, I want to explain why space-time is such a useful concept if this above scenario is true. And that is because there are at least examples where a space-time picture emerges generically and dynamically through the, in the presence of matter, through the clocks and rods that you construct from matter. And then you reconstruct, you think that you live in a space-time. So let's go to slide number 3, the introduction and motivation. Slide number 4. So I told you already that I want to start with the canonical metric path integral. And to the best of my knowledge, and I also asked experts like Steve Carlip about that, this is the only known metric path integral that can be treated. So what is necessary for that? The two ingredients are that you do the 2 plus 1 split, so you treat it as a canonical path integral. And then what is also what turns out to be necessary is that you impose a special gauge fixing condition for the refoliation invariance of general relativity, which is the trace of the metric momenta is proportional to a time variable. So if I do that, if I start out with that, I write the canonical path integral as an integral over metric momenta, lapsed shift, then I put in delta functions for the gauge fixing condition, so I put in the CMC condition that the trace of the metric momenta is spatial constant proportional to time, and I put in the gauge fixing condition for the spatial isomorphism, I put in for the top of determinant, and then the usual exponent of a canonical path integral, so I have the vector potential minus the ADM Hamiltonian, which is expressed as a linear combination of scalar constraints. And then it is really, if you know how Shaki and York solved the initial value problem for GR, you can use all these delta functions that appear in this path integral, and that was done by Carlip and other authors in the 90s, and you can reduce the path integral to a path integral on Teichmuller strings. So in two spatial dimensions, and that is a finite dimensional space, it's the space of geometries that have a spatially constant curvature, spatially constant scalar curvature. That's a finite dimensional space parameterized by these Teichmuller parameters that I denote by tau A. And then you find, through using these delta functions, you find shell volume, so the volume that solves all the constraints, is the physical Hamiltonian that generates the time of the. That is actually what Moncrief found several years before. That is the generator of dynamics of Teichmuller. Now if we look at that, it seems awkward that we have to impose special gauge. And in fact, what is usually used is the Fredkin-Minkowski theorem that says, and the folklore is that the partition function does not depend on the gauge fixing at all. But if you look a little bit closer into that, then what it really says, and I'm not even quoting the precise mathematical statement, I'm just quoting the spirit here, that the partition function depends on the gauge fixing only through the gauge equivalent class of gauge fixing. What I mean with that is two gauge fixing conditions that can be transformed into each other by a gauge transformation lead to the same partition function. But there are known examples, and I've quoted that here, where you can explicitly see the non-equivalent. You have gauge fixing conditions that are in different connected components. And if you look at it from that angle, you have to ask yourself, why is the gauge fixing class, the TNT class, why does that appear to be special? This is particularly puzzling because it's not a very natural gauge fixing condition from the point of view of space time. So if I look at that and if I say this is not the fact that I can reduce the passenger growth to a quantum mechanical system, it's not an accident that there is actually a deeper reason behind it, then I have to take the 2 plus 1 split and the CMC condition seriously for quantization. I'll go to the next slide, and I can give you a tentative answer for that, because the CMC equivalence doesn't, of course, as I argued in previous talks, equivalent to the shape dynamics. All you have to know from these previous talks is that a shape dynamic, the statement of shape dynamics is that gravity can be described as the evolution of spatial conformity. If I just keep that sentence, then I can write down a shape a path integral for that. So now you see this looks that the partition function is there. Right, looks a lot like the one on the previous slide for the ADM system, just that I did not specify the gauge fixing conditions and that I swapped the ADM scalar constraints for in the exponent for the conformal generator. Base of pi is the generator of conformal. Minus t root g, there's a slight modification to that that actually only moment that differently, only on the trace part of the image, then the conformal, then the usual. Now, if I use that answer for the shape dynamic passive, then for any reasonable gauge fixation, for anything that cuts the conformal orbit exactly once, I can perform the reduction of that passive. And I find again a quantum mechanical system, but so over the Teichmuller space in 2 plus 1 dimension. But the difference is now that the on-shell value of the volume will depend on whatever gauge fixing condition I put into the path. But the statement is that this trick works for all performance. So now if I want to describe, if I want to say something about quantum gravity, I could, a natural thing to say gravity should be an effective field theory that appears in it. So what would the renormalization group tell us about the theory that will appear in it? Well, the first, the renormalization group needs some input. theory space, which in the case of gravity consists of that describe gravity and metric, and the symmetries, the gauge symmetries of that system, which are spatial diffeomorphism, and in the case of the shape dynamics description, it's spatial conformal invariance. Then you can also impose, because you can find regulators that do not violate this condition, that you can impose that the action will always be given in spatial derivatives, or that the gauge fixing condition will always be given in spatial derivative, and invariant under time reverse. And then what will generically happen, there are non-generic, but what will generically happen is that the dimensionally irrelevant term will disappear at low energy. Then I can just write down what the preferred gauge fixing is low energy. I prefer to write it as an exponential delta function as an exponential function with the kernel, right? And this would be kernel chi that I didn't write. Now if you look at that, that looks already a lot like ADM scalar constraint, except that I have too many free coupling. Next slide. Let's investigate those coupling constants from the point of view.
Could I ask you to speak up a little louder? You're getting a little quieter again.
Okay. All right. So if we go to the slide number 6 now, and we look at those coupling constants and what they do, if you look at them on conformal superspace, if you say that gravity is about evolution of spatial conformal geometry. Well, first you notice that this coupling constant B in front of this spatial in front of R really converts time derivatives into spatial derivatives. So it is really a definition of the square of the speed of light. So that is not independently observable. It just gives you the speed of light. And also, a little more subtle is that this coupling constant C that I have in front of the volume term, that can be removed by a dynamical similarity of this system, which is basically using the fact that you can write the system without dimension if you're just considering the evolution curve on conformal superspace. And what it is precisely is I can do a simultaneous rescaling of the metric momenta of the time variable and of this coupling constant C such that that solution curves are mapped into solution curves on conformal superspace. So if I just look at the curve or at the succession of conformal geometries, then I cannot observe this coupling constant either. And so I end up with a theory that has two coupling constants, which I can at the end identify with the Newton constant and the cosmological constant in the IR. And so the generic gauge fixing condition will be indistinguishable on conformal superspace from GR. So in the sense that that gravity is about the evolution of spatial conformal geometry, I will not be able to distinguish these two from each other. And just as a side remark, we are currently trying to do explicit calculations of 3+1 path integral, which is of course much harder. But if I take this, observation, these two observations, seriously, then I can come to some provocative conclusion, which is, at least in 2+1 dimensions, the quantization suggests that the fundamental description of gravity is the evolution of spatial conformal geometry, and that space-time is just an emergent concept in the IR, and essentially space-time is abstracted from how matter falls. And that is, we have expressed that view in earlier papers, but I want, at the end of this talk, I want to give you much more detailed example of how space-time. So let's go to the next slide. If I take this provocative conclusion seriously, then I run into the problem. So if the spatial conformal geometry is really the fundamental description of gravity, how does space-time emerge? That is the question that I want to consider in the rest of the talk. So first, I will show you in two explicit examples, two very simple but tractable explicit examples, that the conformal evolution differs from a space-time Lotov Einstein's equation. And then, so if you take that seriously, then you should really, then there are really observable differences between the two descriptions. And, but then I come to the conclusion at the, I will give you an explicit example in which I can reconstruct space-time, in which space-time spontaneously emerges from the dynamical laws. And I will do that in Newtonian. Let's go to the next slide. This part of the talk is now concerned with how the conformal evolution differs from space-time. Go to slide number 9. So, formally, this is at a purely mathematical level. Let's consider we have a solution to the shape dynamics. This is, I have a spatial conformal geometry. This is what I denote by g hat of t. So I have a curve of conformal geometries and maybe shift vectors that are non-zero. But this is the solution to the dynamical problem. Now the mathematical problem is find a scale, find a conformal factor omega of t and the lapsed function n of t such that the space-time metric that I construct from putting the lap, the shift, and now the scaled metric into the ADM decomposition of the four metric such that g mu nu solves Einstein's equation. So I want to stress that is a non-dynamical problem. So the dynamical problem has been solved before, and that is really just inventing some auxiliary values for some auxiliary fields, n and omega, such that the four metric with all its extra degrees of freedom satisfies that. What many of you will probably know, and what I also expressed in previous talk, is that you have to satisfy two elliptic equations. The Laplace has to satisfy the CFD Laplace equation with particular normalization condition, and the conformal factor has to satisfy the Lichtenberg-Yerkes equation. Now these equations are generically solvable for physical metrics, but now comes the subtlety. It may be that these equations require that they have solutions, but that these solutions, omega and n, may vanish or diverge somewhere. And so, although you can solve completely the conformal evolution problem, so g hat for the conformal metric evolution is fine, you cannot find well-defined space-time metric. That's how I said. So that is what I mean with that there are conformal evolutions without corresponding geometry. Now I want to give you two simple and tractable examples. One is Bianchi 1 on a compact space on a torus, Bianchi 1 cosmology, and the other is a thin shell collapse of just one. Let's go to slide number 10. So for Bianchi 1, this is, I'm I'm considering pure gravity, which is possible for an RJ constant. So there I have, there I consider homogeneous metric. The homogeneous metric are parameterized by the volume of the torus, and again by Teichmuller parameters, which are just specifying the shape of that torus, so basically the angles between the main axis and the length ratios between the great circles of that. And then if I work out what the CFT system, then I arrive at the shape dynamic Hamiltonian, and it's just a geodesic Hamiltonian, so it's just the square root of the momenta squared. And I have a conformal constraint, a global conformal constraint, which says that the total volume is pure gauge. Now, I want to, so now if I were to take that Hamiltonian at face value, I would already differ from GR, but because I would use a different parametrization, a different time parametrization. But I want to get rid of the time parametrization at all. I just want to consider the curves of conformal geometry that are generated by this dynamical system. So I can just, so what I can do is I can look at the reparametrization. This is how the ADM constraints are written usually as dynamical generators. So, which is that that there is the constant of motion H naught for each curve, and this is preserved along the curve, and the expression is. And this dynamical constraint parameterizes the type of the geodesic on the site. So now I know, so now I've argued that the Bianchi 1 dynamical problem is just finding geodesic on Teichmuller space if I consider it that way. But then Einstein's equation require that I choose a particular lapse and a particular conformal factor. And I gave the explicit formulas there. And you see that the generic trajectory will have a big bang. This is at tau equals minus infinity. There will be, you will have a diverging conformal factor, and you will have an asymptotic freeze-out that can occur anywhere, which is where the lapse diverges, which is when tau squared reaches the critical value such that the argument of the inverse of square root that appears in the lapse approaches zero, then the lapse diverges. And what this, it shows up in the evolution of these universes as the freeze-out of shape. So you get asymptotically, there is no more change in shape of the universe, it will just start expanding forever. But now the important point is, if you look at the dynamical system just being geodesic on Teichmuller space, then both the Big Bang and this asymptotic freeze-out can occur at generic points on geodesic. They're in no way, they're not in no way special. Just by choosing the value of your time parameter carefully, that you can shift them around. You can shift these points around where they should occur. But consequently, the pure shape dynamics evolves through the Big Bang, and so the conformal evolution goes through the Big Bang and past the end of time, because I can extend the geodesic in Teichmuller space goes past the point of asymptotic freeze-out, and there is an evolution of conformal geometry after that. So this is reminiscent as a tree of Penrose's cyclic wife cosmology, but of course it's a three-dimensional analog. Now, if we go to the next slide, there I have a separate example, which is I consider a thin irrotational shell in an asymptotically flat spacetime. Now, if you have spherical symmetry, then shape dynamics is not dynamical. And it's very simple to see, because spherical symmetry plus suitably strong asymptotically flat boundary conditions imply that the spatial geometry is conformally flat. And so if it's conformally flat, there is the only thing that could be, the only freedom that I have is the conformal fraction, that is pure gauge. So in the shape dynamics description, so there is no gravitational evolution. So this means that the physical evolution is all in the, is completely contained in the matter degree of freedom. So let's look at the physical evolution of a thin gravitational shell, and you can do that with standard test. You can, but you can use any kind of sensible matter for that. So I already argued all physical degrees of freedom are shell degrees of freedom. So for example, the radius of the shell and the conjugate momentum. If you have different components of the shell, or if the shell has some internal states, you would also have those degrees of freedom in there. And the physical Hamiltonian that you would use to evolve this would then be the matter Hamiltonian, but you would multiply it by the CMC lab, and you would put the scale in of that Hamiltonian, you would choose the conformal factor that solves the Schneeritz-Yorck equation. And it's straightforward when you look at that Hamiltonian, that that evolution will stick when the CMC lab vanishes. And this is actually what happens when you do CMC evolution of thin shell collapse. You see that there will be a, if you have contracting, if you have collapsing initial data, it will start to collapse, and then as the shell reaches what will become the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole that is going to be formed, the lapse goes to zero, which is just expressing the fact that if you are in the asymptotically flat region, and you look at that, you see that this shell, which is get infinitely redshifted as it approaches, as it starts to form. But then you look at, then I also impose that it's irrotational, and that means that the ADM mass of that system will be conserved. So no matter what I do in detail with the matter Hamiltonian, no matter what I use at the very beginning, I can write again the generator of dynamics as in a reparametrization form, which is basically that the mass, that the ADM mass is conserved along the evolution. And I have again a reparametrization invariant description of the system, and then I can just choose a particular parametrization. And one that turns out to be useful is to take the log of y proportional to your d. And in that, this parametrization condition, of course, doesn't see that the DMC lab goes to zero somewhere. And I can solve the dynamical problem, in particular if I just have the radius and the conjugate momentum as the physical freedom, and I can solve the parametrization condition for r and plug that value in the formula for the ADM mass and solve that for its conjugate momentum, and I have the dynamical problem. So it evolves through this n equals zero region. And then I can go back and I can just take the CMC Labs equation and the Lichtenberg-Yorck equation seriously and ask which conformal factor and which lab now do I have to choose so I satisfy Einstein's equation. And I find the expressions that I quoted here, which is on the outside of the shell, you have essentially an isotropic line element on the inside. You have something that is essentially Minkowski. It is written in an awkward way. If you write, if you see, in the first summary, both of these formulas contain a little r, which is the coordinate, and the second summons contain a capital R, which is the radius of the shell, which is not a coordinate, so it's really a homogeneous part there. So that's why the inside is an open ball in space, and the type of space, and that's the solution to the equation. So what I get is I get a dynamic generation of an isotropic line element through this matter collapse, which is of course not the from the outside it looks outside the Schwarzschild radius it is isometric to the Schwarzschild solution, but if you take that as face value, that is the solution, the fundamental solution. Excuse me. If you take that as the conformal evolution seriously as the fundamental description of gravity, then you generate an isotropic line element, which is essentially a wormhole, which is not a vacuum solution to Einstein. There would be a considerable difference between the two. So let's go to the next slide, number 12. And I want to summarize the differences. So on the one hand, shape dynamics is constructed to be locally indistinguishable from GR, but we saw that there are differences. So what are the requirements? So if you look a little closely at that problem, you see if you want to come from a space-time and go to the conformal description, then of course it requires a Hamiltonian formulation. So you need global hyperbolicity at first, and then you need even more. You need CMC foliability for the patch or the chunk of space-time that you want to evolve. But that is when you come from space-time and you want to conformal. So if either of these conditions break down, you don't have exact equivalence. Or if you take the conformal description to be fundamental and you want to find the space-time that solves Einstein's equations, then the problematic point can be that the lab vanishes or diverges, or that the conformal factor. So despite the local indistinguishability of the two descriptions, there can be global differences. And as a side remark to conclude that part of the talk, we saw in both cases, in the Bianchi 1 and in the Simshell collapse, that singularity was somehow avoided. Big Bang singularity was evolved through without a problem because it was just in the it just occurred in the volume. And in the Simshell collapse, I argued that actually the interior of the black hole is actually not there, that they are generated. And there is actually a reason for that, and that is because the conformal evolution avoids focusing requires volume focusing is pure gauge in the so this means of course that focusing arguments do not predict a breakdown of the conformal evolution. That avoids an essential step in many things. And this is essentially why the conformal evolution. But I want to caution you that that's not a general singularity avoidance mechanism. The conformal evolution can still have molecular space for that parameterizes the shape of three-dimensional tori, then the angle between two of the main axes is zero. So that will actually not be a three-dimensional choice anymore, but a two-dimensional choice. So that kind of, that is definitely a this change of dimension is definitely a viable event that you would get the similarity or that you would like to call it a similarity. That is not avoided by the control. Just wanted to add that part at the end of the summary. And now that I have laid out my case that that maybe space-time is not fundamental and the conformal evolution is, go to the next slide.
Okay. Could we stop you and ask some questions at this stage?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, for the Bianchi model, one doesn't really need the shape dynamics to kind of argue about this kind of singularity resolution, right? Because one could just look at the mini superspace, and then it was shown long time ago that in the mini superspace, of course, the dynamical trajectories are just null geodesics. And if I look at mini superspace, then it has a flat metric with a signature minus plus plus. And then if I look at the scry minus of that, that corresponds to the standard singularity. And of course, if I just look at null geodesic and don't care about the affine parameter, then I can just continue across scry minus.
That's right. I'm not saying that I reinvented the wheel. I'm just saying take that this is the natural interpretation when you look at the evolution of spatial conformal geometry. I completely agree with you.
That actually sets the stage for the question, which is that. So, but if I now look at some foliation, and if I go back to this, in other words, along this null geodesic stick, I go back, what I can calculate is the electric and magnetic parts of the Y sensor. And I can calculate them in terms of initial data, because it's a vacuum space time. And in Bianchi 1 model, of course, the one that you consider is vacuum, so RAB is equal to 0. So the standard singularity corresponds to the Y tensor blowing up. The standard singularity corresponds to Weyl tensor blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what foliation of this space-time you use, and the Weyl tensor is conformally invariant.
I understand. The four-dimensional Weyl tensor is conformally invariant. I'm looking at the three-dimensional conformal, at the three-dimensional conformal geometry.
Right.
At the evolution of that, and not at the evolution of the four-dimensional conformal geometry.
But still, the Bach tensor of the three-dimensional Bach tensor is expressible, because everything is expressible in terms of the electric and magnetic parts of the Weyl tensor. So why doesn't something blow up? What I'm understanding is really, it's one thing to say that I'm looking at only those fields which do not diverge. That's fine. But one also has to give physical interpretation. Now, in the normal way of looking at it, one would say that if the Weyl tensor blows up, that means that the tidal forces become infinite. Well, one can also formulate it using some Maxwell fields or some other fields. It just takes longer to say this. One normally would say that if our electric and magnetic parts of the Weyl tensor blow up, then, in fact, the tidal forces become infinite. And basically what you're saying is that is not one of the things you're going to look at. Then you have to tell us what is replacing this standard physics, right? I mean, it's one thing to just evolve equations and another thing to give physical interpretation to what you're doing.
I'm using these as motivating examples at this point. You're right that I have to be careful how to physically interpret what is going on. My conjecture, which may be wrong, is at this point that actually in the that because the three-dimensional conform the three-dimensional geometries are conformally flat, the tori are conformally flat, so that there is nothing happening with there, but I would have to work out the equation before I can say that. That's just a conjecture.
Yeah, you have to also look at the time derivative of the geometries. But okay,
yes,
thank you very much.
My conjecture, the second part, what I would conjecture is that what causes the four-dimensional wire tensor to blow up is all in the time component. So it's all in the time dependence, and it has nothing to do with the spatial difference. But I mean, that's a conjecture. I would have to verify that.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I ask a question to clarify your answer, Tim, to a bias question?
I didn't understand what you were saying.
Yeah, I just want to ask, just to clarify your answer to a bias question. It is a mathematical statement that the singularity is not removed in the sense that there are still functions of the space-time curvature that could be infinite, but it's evolved through. So the notion that the singularity represents the boundary of space-time is eliminated.
Yes, that's definitely the idea that I'm the assumption under which I work.
And then your physical argument would be that the conformally invariant spatial geometry is physically fundamental, and the space-time geometry, for example, the components of the Weyl curvature, are secondary and emergent, and therefore, if they diverge, it's not physically a catastrophe the way it is if you interpret the space-time geometry as fundamental. Is that your argument?
That is how I approach the problem, but to give precise answers to a wise question, I would first want to work out the equation.
I understand. This is a conjecture. This is a conjecture in the full theory at this point. You just have an example.
But I think we should go on, and maybe we can have this discussion again at the end. But I don't agree with you, Lee, that if the philosophy is that, in fact, what is important is just the spatial geometry. It's a bit like saying that what is important is just a spatial metric, and not, I mean, which actually spatial metric has more information than spatial conformal geometry. I mean, somehow it's saying that the momentum of that object has no meaning or has no physical interpretation. And that is just not enough to talk about physics. So, again, you would not be able to talk about tidal forces just using the spatial metric per se. You will not be able to, I mean, you need both the metric and the extrinsic curvature in the normal formulation. And so here also you would need both the conformal geometry and the conjugate momentum in the least.
So I'm not disagreeing with you. Let's discuss at the end.
Okay.
Thank you.
So let's go on to slide number 13, which
you have to speak up a little bit, Tim, again.
Yes. Let's go on to slide number 13. Now I want to make a case by even if space-time is not a fundamental concept, that there are examples in which space-time generically emerges spontaneously from the dynamics. And that is based on recent work with Julie Barber and Flavio Mercati. So let's go to slide number 14. We consider in this paper as our guiding example. We work with some GR examples, but as the guiding example is the Newtonian universe, so we consider an in-body problem. So the ingredients in that model of the universe are the following. We consider the entire universe, so not a subsystem, so we don't want to put any extraneous frame or scale into that. And that means that for the n-body problem, we have to put in energy zero, angular momentum zero, linear momentum zero, because any of these quantities not vanishing would require that we put in a time parameterization or preferred frame or preferred scale. So then we look at the evolution of gravitating matter, so just using Newton's equations in a reparametrization invariant form. And then we consider what is the generic consequence of the dynamical law. So in particular, what I want to stress is our statements are not considering special initial conditions, and we're not considering ensembles. What I drew in the middle, this picture in the middle of the slide, is a Newtonian universe with energy zero, angular momentum zero, linear momentum zero.
Tim?
And yes?
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I think someone has maybe the microphone on, so there's like a there's a feedback that we can hear, and we cannot hear you very clearly. So if someone could check if the microphones are turned off.
Okay, is that better now?
No, there's still this like feedback. So if you can please make sure that all the microphones are turned off.
Okay, can I go on?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Okay. So what I drew in the middle of this slide is a Newtonian universe of this n-body problem, and to the left I drew a cartoon of the early stage of the evolution, and to the right a cartoon of the late stage of the evolution, and in the center is a distinguished point, which is the point of minimal expansion of that universe, and that will it's ensured by mathematical theorems that there will be a unique point of minimal expansion in the generic solution. And if you just look at that picture, it is already it suggests actually the correct thing, which is the statement. There is one particular point in time that is singled out by this Newtonian universe having minimal expansion. And in both time directions away from that, you will have the formation of clusters and subsystems, which I drew as these Kepler pairs on the states on the left and the right of that, and maybe some isolated particles also. And they will just fly away from each other, these subsystems or isolated particles. So the observation from that from just looking at this picture is that the time reversal symmetry in Newton's equation is in every solution is broken into a qualitative inversion property around this point of minimal expansion. So now if we take that, we have something that is reminiscent of Boltzmann's one past and two futures scenario, where you have one, in Boltzmann's picture, it's a large entropy fluctuation, but here we're really looking just at the state of the system. One singled out point in the past, and one can evolve in both time directions, and both time directions will look at the future forever from that point onward. So it's only an ambiguity around of time reflection around this one point. So let's go to the next slide, number 15. So what I want to argue on this slide is that a well-defined notion of complexity grows, and that it actually gives you a notion of the error of time. And the measure of complexity of this n-body problem that I want to suggest is this quantity Cs that I write there, which is the ratio of the root mean square length and the mean harmonic length, which is essentially the square root of the moment of inertia, the root mean, makes the root mean square length, and the mean harmonic length is the inverse of the Newton potential. And this ratio measures how many Kepler pairs have, or how many subsystems have formed in the embodied problem, and how pronounced, so how well separated they are from each other. And the reason why that happens is basically because the root mean square length is dominated by the average distance, while the mean harmonic length is dominated by the minimal distance. And that gives you the plot that is in the on the left-hand side of the top box, which is at the center of this plot, there is the point of minimal expansion, and qualitatively, in both directions around this point of minimal expansion, there is a growth of structural complexity in the embodied problem. So this quantity has two properties that you can that are actually you can show mathematically. The first one is not so simple to show. It follows from theorems that were established 30 or 40 years ago in the n-body problem. It has it has a secular growth. So there is it is a bounded quantity that has a growing lower bound. So it has to grow on large time scales. Actually, in numerical simulations, we find that if you have a lot of particles, so this plot up that is on top is for 1,000 particles. If you have 10,000 particles, it's much more like time. If you increase the number of particles, it will start to be even more just hovering above the growing lower bound. And of course, because it's the ratio of two characteristic length scales in that system, it is scale invariant, so it's an appropriate measure for the whole universe if we don't want to put in any external reference. So this gives us a suggestion for how to choose the arrow of time in each of these halves from the point of minimum expansion, which is just identify the arrow of time as the direction of secular growth of this complexity function. And this implements, in a sense, the idea that time is deduced from the formation of local structure. Now, let's make that a little more clear on the next page. There is actually a more intuitive and more information-related picture to that. Because this growth of complexity coincides with the secular growth of complexity coincides with the growth of dynamically generated local information. And what I first have to give you is the generic late time evolution of the particle. So for all solutions except for a subset of measure zero in phase space, the n-body problem fragments into subsystems. These are systems that have where the separation of particles are bounded by t to the 2/3, and clusters, which are subsystems or parts of subsystems where the particles stay close together. And the n-body problem is forced. The dynamical law forces the n-body problem to fragment into those. And these subsystems develop definite energies, that's what I denote with EI, angular momentum, and linear motion. And all these quantities are defined with respect to the center of mass of the whole n-body problem. And they have a particular asymptotic behavior for large t in both time direction, so it could be t to plus or minus infinity. And this is the energy takes its asymptotic value e infinity plus order of t to the minus 5, so then you see the other two asymptotic evolutions. Which means that the subsystem will approach the energy that you calculate for the Newtonian energy that you calculate for the subsystem will be more and more accurately the energy E infinity, and the same for the asymptotic value E infinity, and the same is true for the components of the angular momentum and the components of the linear motion. So now I can define a sensible notion of local information that is dynamically generated in the system and preserved by the dynamic by just I put all these energies, angular momentum and linear motion into one, all these components into all subsystems into a long vector, and I consider how many bits of that are preserved for all t after a certain t naught, or for all capital T after a t. And that is a number, that is information that is dynamically generated and then preserved by the evolution of that. So by construction, this information grows generically because of the asymptotic behavior that I quoted in the top box of the here. And with the arguments that I gave, it measures locally accessible and dynamically stored information. So it implements in a way the idea that the passage of time is deduced from the increase of amount of records, of amount of information that is locally stored, preserved by the dynamic. So now I have argued that the error of time is dynamic, is spontaneously generated on each side of the point of interaction. If we go to the next slide, I will also argue that actually, this is slide number 17, that actually the whole Newtonian space-time geometry is dynamic, is spontaneously generated. And that is because the late-time evolution will contain an abundance of Kepler pairs, or solar systems. And because these solar systems will separate from each other, the forces between them will become very small. So in each of these solar systems, Kepler's third law will become more and more accurate, so you will have spontaneously emergent clocks that will become very accurate clocks. Area law. And also the perihelion or aphelion distance from in these Kepler pairs will become very stable. So also local rods will emerge spontaneously in that system. And that happens in every solution. So now I have local clocks, and they emerge all over the Newtonian n-body problem, but at late times they will become more and more isochronous. They emerge more, better and better in step, and the relative variations between them will become smaller and smaller, and in fact go to zero. The same is true for rods. You have emergent local rods, and the relative, the ratios between their lengths will be preserved with increasing accuracy at late time. And actually the fluctuations will also go to zero. And then if you use these locally available clocks and rods to measure the evolution of your neighborhood in this n-body problem, then you will find that the Newtonian space-time will emerge spontaneously from these local relational degrees of freedom. So it's a property of the dynamical law and not the initial condition, because every generic solution generates these clocks and rods, and they become good clocks and rods in the sense that they become that they march in step, and that the ratios between those rods stay the same. And the dynamical laws then take the form of standard Newtonian laws if you use these units, use the units that are set by the clock. Additionally, this is, I don't want to talk about it in this talk, this emergent global scale that that emerges in every solution can be felt from the shape evolution, so just from the evolution without a scale as a friction term in their dynamics. That would be the topic of a whole separate talk. What I want for you to take away from that is that in the Newtonian n-body problem, there is, so in a Newtonian universe, you have a spontaneous, you have a way to spontaneously generate a geometry, space-time geometry, and that is independent. That is independent of the initial condition. That is a generic. That is the generic behavior. And we are currently working on how that happens in Einstein gravity. There are several complications, of course, when you consider matter evolution coupled to gravity. But at some formal level, there are a lot of similarities between these two models. So at least there's hope that something like that can happen in full GR coupled. So let me come to the summary of this talk. This is slide number 18. So I gave a motivation from the 2 plus 1 dimensional path integral that can be used to motivate that conformal evolution may be fundamental, or maybe at least as fundamental as the space-time description of gravity. And what I argued in previous talks, and I didn't do that so much here, is that this conformal evolution is locally, in a neighborhood, indistinguishable from general relativity or space-time that solves Einstein's equations. What I mean with that is, of course, that around any event in space-time, I can find neighborhood. I can set boundary conditions on this neighborhood and initial conditions such that the two evolutions are completely indistinguishable. But then these neighborhoods may only be finite, so there can be global differences between the conformal evolution and space-time. And it may be that they lead to objective, they can, looking at these two problems can lead to objective differences. And it could be that observations will tell us that we should abandon space-time. And if of course the prediction of the conformal evolution observation, that is, which would then contradict. But that is of course a conjecture. Right now we're just trying to find predictions of this. And then if that scenario is true, so if the conformal evolution is really the fundamental picture that underlies gravity, then we have to ask, why is space-time such a good description? And for that, I gave an example that space-time emerges spontaneously in the Newtonian limit. So I gave you this example that the arrow of time emerges spontaneously around the point of minimal expansion, and that it implements the idea that time is deduced from the growth of complexity and locally available information, and also that local clock and rod emerge spontaneously in the generic solution of this problem, and that they pretend that they live in a space-time, so you really see a space-time emerging at late times in the embodied problem. But what I wanted to stress with that is, the way we formulated the embodied problem did not presuppose that. So we used a completely time reparametrization invariant way, a completely scale invariant way to describe the system from the onset in a that is a consequence of the special form of the dynamical law, and that we had that we did not have to put that in the initial condition. That, of course, leads to the question. So right now we just took the we just performed some mathematical steps to have manifest equivalence with Newton's laws, but to express them in a reparametrization and scale invariant way. But this leads to the natural question, are there other dynamical laws that lead to a spontaneous dynamical emergence of space-time? And that is something that we are definitely interested in. So let's go to slide number 19. Thank you for your attention, and I want to acknowledge at this point the work of my collaborators that are listed here, and also useful discussions that I have with various people on this subject.
Questions?
So if I make an, I'd like to make a comment and then a question.
Go ahead.
The comment is really that if I look at connection dynamics, you know, the standard way that in loop quantum gravity we formulate Einstein's theory, then indeed it is the case that connection dynamics is more general than standard general relativity. And the reason for that is basically that even when the density-weighted tetras become degenerate, the equations do not break. And you can continue through certain configurations or certain three-dimensional configurations, which one would not normally do in general relativity because the metric becomes singular there. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, I mean, it was known that this is the case, and people even, you know, people like Ted Jacobson even developed kind of generalized causal theory for these degenerate metrics, etc. But somehow the viewpoint is not that this is a dramatic different way of doing general relativity, or we are completely breaking, making a break, and this is a completely fresh perspective, etc. Right? I mean, the generalization involved is definitely there, but on the global scope of things, it is generally felt that this is kind of a small corner which may be of interest in certain cases. Ted Jacobson talks about molten space-times, or, you know, space melting of space-time, and the causal structure becomes very general because of the because the metric becomes degenerate or even vanishes and so on. Now, it seems to me that by analogy, the shape dynamics is very similar, that it is such a slight generalization of general relativity or slight difference from general relativity coming from three-person perspective. So I sort of am a little bit puzzled by the big conceptual points that are being made here. Somehow I feel that it is interesting to observe this, but it's not something so dramatically different from ordinary general relativity.
No, of course. Of course, these differences are not dramatic, but we are grasping for a tractable difference that would lead to an observational distinction between the conformal picture and a space-time that solves Einstein's equation. And if there is such a prediction, and I mean, it was last week I gave a similar talk to this in a cosmology seminar, and there were observational cosmologists who said it would be very interesting to look at, for example, replace a black hole, a Schwarzschild black hole, a non-rotating black hole, with an isotropic line element, or a Kerr black hole with something that takes the Boyer-Lindquist form of the line element seriously as the fundamental description also of the entire dynamical system. and see if there would be like high energetic particle emissions or something that people could actually observe and then either contradict the picture, confirm that space-time is really the more fundamental description, or confirm that the conformal evolution is the fundamental description. So this is what we're aiming at. So, I mean, this is a dangerous game. We may come to a prediction that really excludes that, but that is science. And so that is why we're doing that. It's not, I completely agree, it's not a dramatic change in that. And what we really look at right now is what are the consequences for quantization when if you take the conformal evolution seriously. So in the middle of the talk, I mentioned that we're currently working on explicit calculations with the 3+1 passenger growth, and I mean that's the hope that we make progress there, which is also an analogy connection dynamics, the connection dynamic description of gravity, that is the big hope in the loop quantum gravity program, that you can make fundamental progress through using a different description and taking that description as the starting point for your quantum theory.
Since you mentioned that, I mean, I think I mentioned to you privately that, in fact, before the connection variables were found, in fact, Cristodulo and I were looking at precisely the...
I remember that.
And it did the intractability of the Hamiltonian constraint in this picture,
yes.
That Hamiltonian constraint became so complicated, the Lichnerian equation, basically. That is why we went over to... I stopped doing this and went over to look for something else.
Yes, so in a sense, we tried to brave you out in
yeah.
that... in
okay.
that adventure.
You are retaking it and seeing if it's like
something. We're reconsidering. I mean, we're aware of the literature that was produced by. It ended sometime in the late 80s, where that line of research was stopped, and we're trying to pick up from there and taking some. I mean, there have been a lot of lessons that we learned about quantum gravity in the past 20 years, and take them into consideration when we reconsider.
So let me ask the question that I have, which is just a small question about Newtonian system. I think the noise is too much, so maybe I can just ask you privately. Is it okay now? There's no noise now? Is that right?
I can hear you clearly now.
Okay. So this was about the Newtonian picture. The way I understood you saying was that, you know, to begin with, we consider configuration in which energy was zero, angular momentum was zero, and momentum was zero. But to define these objects, one just use ordinary Newtonian mechanics.
Yes. So, I mean... This is what I do to explain to you in normal terms what this model is. But of course, our whole philosophy is find a dynamical system that you can define without an external time parametrization, without an external scale, and without an external frame. That is what we...
But then you have to define quantities like energy and angular momentum and momentum.
Yeah, this is what I'm trying to say. This is the explanation if you know what the Newtonian n-body problem. I mean, you know Newton's equation. Then I'm telling you, if you take in the standard Newtonian description, energy zero, angular momentum zero, linear momentum zero, then you can write an equivalent dynamical system that has no scale in it, that is has no frame in it, and there is a scale invariant description of that system as well. So this is So I think what you're trying to ask is, how can I define total energy equals zero, total angular momentum equals zero, and so on, in a relational picture? And I can't. I cannot do that.
Just a clarification. Thank you.
Okay.
More questions?
I have a question. Intuitively, you talked about the secular growth away from this point of minimal expansion. And intuitively, this would seem to be related to growth of entropy. But do you know of any way that these two could be precisely related, secular growth and growth of entropy?
So there is this one small remark that I made at the end, that this emergent scale, actually, if you look at the equations of motion, this emergent scale that emerges from the dynamics of the n-body problem, that acts as a friction term formally, in just at a formal mathematical level, as a friction term. And so you have something that looks like a dissipative equation. And of course, when you have dissipative equations, you can define an entropy for that dissipative system. And we have actually considered that in the paper that I quoted, the joint work with Julian Barber and Flavio Mercati. We consider that. And at this point, this is the closest relation to entropy that we have. It's formal analogy in equation.
Thank you. That's interesting.
More questions? So I have a question. As you mentioned, this locally, this is equivalent to general relativity. Now, I understand if you have singularities and so on, then the two theories could sort of disagree. But in regions of low curvature, like in the exterior of a black hole, everything should be equivalent, right? So I don't see the possibility that you could contradict anything or lead to experimental.
Yes, so the predictions would be very, you would have to look very closely. I'm not the expert on that, but as I said last week, I gave a similar talk to cosmologists at Perimeter, and they were telling me maybe through that would, if there was a different interior of the black hole, that would affect Hawking radiation, and that you could actually observe that, and that there could actually be some cosmic ray burst that would be different, or something like that, that where you could actually look for blips in the data that would make this different. I did not understand this argument, but I'm very interested, of course, in hearing what people would do to distinguish this experimentally.
Okay.
Can I make a comment?
Go ahead.
I mean, I think there are two perspectives on the significance of this. One has to do with the quantum theory, where the two quantum theories are expected to be different because the famous question of time and interpretation of the wheel of the DeWitt equation and so forth is completely different in a quantum shape dynamics as opposed to a quantum general relativity. But the second is, even at the classical level, and even given that there are no new predictions, the change in perspective can illuminate questions that are mysterious in the standards way of thinking about things. And I think that what Tim presented was very quick, but what Tim presented about the breaking of time symmetry in Newtonian dynamics could be stated completely in the language of Newtonian dynamics, but it was revealed by work in the scale invariant relational form of the dynamics, which is the analog of shape dynamics and Newtonian dynamics. And the claim is very, as I understand it right, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, the claim is very ambitious. The claim is that the famous column, the Arrow of Time, which under the usual perspective is relegated to a very special initial condition, so-called past hypothesis, is now to be explained completely dynamically to generic initial condition. And it is a profound addition to our understanding if it's correct. Even if it's equivalent, an equivalent description, it's still a profound insight into the nature of time and the issue of irreversibility and the origin of the arrows of time in nature.
Yes, so I agree with you. This is definitely what we are aiming at, to replace the past hypothesis with something that is the generic consequence of the dynamical law of the universe, a fully relational.
More questions? Okay, let's thank him again.